It's the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack in for Faith. This show is about the richness of life. Thank you for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Many churches around the country are struggling with declining attendance, prompting some interesting questions and conversations. Is it the message, a sign of the times, the church's mission? Maybe it's past controversies. But there's one small church in Denver, Colorado, that doesn't have any problem filling its seats on Sundays. In fact, it's a little too crowded, if such a thing can be said about church-going. The name alone speaks volumes. It's called House for All Sinners and Saints. Its founding pastor, Nadia Bowles Weber, carries messages that resonate with her parishioners, but she'll be the first to tell you she's the least likely candidate for the priesthood. She's a 6'1", heavily tattooed, ordained Lutheran minister. But before that, she was a stand-up comic with a big drinking problem, something she shares with many of her parishioners who also struggle with issues like addiction and depression. She's been described as sardonic, cranky, and prone to colorful language. She's also a sought-after speaker in the United States and abroad, and is the author of the New York Times best-selling memoir, Pastrix. Her latest book is called Accidental Saints, Finding God in All the Wrong People. Nadia Bowles Weber joins us today by phone from Pasadena, California, where she's on tour for her book. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So I have to ask, why did you want to start your own Lutheran church?
Well, I had to start a church I'd want to show up to, I think is basically the reason. I feel like I have to culturally commute from who I am to who most mainline Protestant churches are. And it's just not something I'm willing to do. So I really wanted a worshiping community where I felt like I could show up as is and everyone else could show up as is. And so I started House for All Sinners and Saints.
Can you talk about the beginning of your church? How many were in your congregation at the time? And who was your congregation when you started?
Well, it was hard to even call it a congregation when it started. It was just eight people in my living room. And half of them were gay and lesbian folks, and several of them were people I knew from seminary. I was in seminary at the time, actually, when this started. And I knew I was going to start a church, and I just thought, well, let's just start small. Let's start by once a month sharing a meal, praying together, and speaking honestly about our lives, and that was the origin. I mean, we didn't start having a sort of public worship service where other people were coming for a good 6 months.
Can we go back to when you were drinking for a second? I'm trying to get an idea of where you were spiritually at that point.
Yeah, I mean, even though I came from this really conservative religious upbringing that I rejected, I never really managed to be an atheist. I never sort of stopped believing in God. I stopped being interested in hanging out with Christians, but that didn't mean that I stopped believing in God. And I sort of explored a lot of different spiritual avenues. I mean, when you're raised a church kid like me, I went to church like three times a week for 17 years. You don't just become not a church person in a way. And so I tried to find that sense of spiritual community and practice in other places. So I hung out with Quakers for a while and hung out with Unitarians and did the whole sort of Wicca pagan thing. And I'm really grateful for all of those experiences. I mean, they each taught me something and brought me something. But when it's too hard to not be Christian when that's just how you were raised. It's a very recent idea in human history that you can just choose your symbol system. And that's the one that really formed me. And so in a way, that's the one that also had to sort of call me back home and heal me, even though it was also the origin of so much sort of pain early on in my life.
And you weren't brought up in a Lutheran church as a child.
Oh, definitely not. No. I was raised in the Church of Christ, which is kind of like Baptist plus. It was a very sectarian kind of fundamentalist church that I was raised in. Women were not allowed to pray out loud in front of men, as a matter of fact.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So you went to the Iliff School of Theology. What brought you there? How did you get there from where you were?
Well, I'd become Lutheran by then because I married somebody who was a Lutheran seminary student at the time. And so I had sort of been exposed to this Lutheran theology is very distinct because it's really all centered on grace. And grace to me is just the most sort of disruptive and powerful force in the world and something I'd encountered. And so to find a theological system that was really centered on grace meant a lot to me because it feels like so many theological systems are centered on accomplishing something, you know, on sort of good works or trying to be better, self-improvement or discipleship, you know, being a better disciple. And like this one is really centered on grace. So I'd already sort of fallen in love with Lutheran theology and the liturgy and sacraments of the church. And I'm a late bloomer. I didn't graduate from college till I was 36 in 2005. And so I had graduated with a degree in religion and thought I was going to stay in the academy. And so I went to seminary just to do academic work. And then, you know, it was sort of, you know, this cosmic joke that I ended up being a pastor instead.
So you must have gotten something out of your childhood spiritual upbringing to keep you. I mean, you didn't just leave altogether.
I did. And, you know, that's the thing is like, and it's just so simple, which is, first of all, you know, most people don't, even people have an issue with Christianity, most people don't have an issue with Jesus, right? And so there was this thing, like, even all of the crimes and misdemeanors of Christianity, I mean, papal corruption and dissent in the church and abuse and all of these things, clown ministry, all the crimes and misdemeanors of Christianity are real and they happen and they're horrible and they need to be, you know, people need to be called to account. However, there's still, at the end of the day, there's still Jesus. There's still this thing that, and that thing is the center of gravity. That's what actually draws people into this tradition. And that center of gravity remained in my life, even though I didn't want to have anything to do with the church of my upbringing.
And you do write in the book that you can understand, and in a couple of places you say you can understand how people can be cynical about religion and Christianity in particular, and even how distasteful Christianity can be.
I get it completely. I walked away from the Christian faith for 10 years of my life. So whenever somebody says, look, I don't have anything to do with it, I understand. But the things that caused me so much sort of pain in my life was actually the same place I had to go back to be healed, in a sense. Now, not the same denomination, but the same symbol system. If I could be something other than Christian, I would. Like, if I could be something cooler than Christian, maybe I would, right? But I can't. Like, it's just who I am. There's no way for me to escape it.
What's different about House for All Sinners and Saints than other churches?
Well, I think it's more interesting to start with what's not different. So what's not different is that we use the sort of ordo of the church, meaning our liturgy is in many ways the same liturgy that's being used in Episcopal, Lutheran, Catholic churches all over the world. So we have a gathering rite and we sing hymns and then we have, you know, the service of the word, we read scripture and then there's a sermon and then, you know, we celebrate the Eucharist and we chant the Sanctus and the Agnus Dei and there's a post-communion prayer. I mean, it's very traditional in that way. So in that sense, there's not something that's different about it. So while we're doing the same things, we're doing them in a different way. So it's not conventional, but it is traditional, if that makes sense. So we're doing it in a different way, meaning we're in the round, for instance, right? So we aren't in pews looking at the backs of each other's heads. Because if you look at the way most churches are configured, about a third of the physical space is for the two special people who stand up front.
Right.
Like if they get one third of the physical space, well, that doesn't work for us. And so we've democratized the space. So the altar's in the middle and we're in concentric circles around the altar. The other thing is we're like anti-excellence pro-participation, meaning we aren't really caught up in the idea of excellence, of having things be impressive or shiny or done really well or like a stage show with lights and a band. Like we don't have any of that nonsense. Like all of the music that you hear in the liturgy comes out of the bodies of the people who showed up. We're totally a cappella, and we sing in four-part harmony, so it's like sitting in the middle of a choir, a 200-person choir. And so it's so beautiful, and it's not performative at all. And then also just the people who come, it just, you know, it's like a church filled with people who you wouldn't maybe otherwise see in church. And the thing that makes it especially weird is there's also people who look totally churchy being a community with the people who don't look at all churchy. That's what makes it so weird. Not that there's the people who look unusual, but the fact that they're in community with people who look like bankers and grandma. So, you know, you walk in, you're like, I am unclear what all these people have in common.
This is Pastor Nadia Bowles-Weber. She is a Lutheran minister in Denver, where she founded House for All Sinners and Saints Church. She's written this new book called Accidental Saints. It's about her personal experiences as a pastor, as well as the practices and people of her congregation. You describe some life situations in the book that most of us can really relate to. For instance, how you don't really like to engage in conversation with people you're sitting next to on a plane because, you know, what if they're boring? And you're stuck with them for the next several hours. Everybody can relate to that. And that's a mild one. Most
of all the bad things I say about myself, that is one of the lesser.
That's one of the lesser ones, yes. Most of us aren't used to hearing admissions like that from our pastors. People are drawn to you because of your candor. But has that ever been a problem, your candor?
Well, what do you mean? Like, where I shouldn't have admitted something about myself?
Well, we're not used to hearing pastors admit that kind of stuff. It's a really, you know, it's honest. And that's not to say that most pastors aren't honest. It's just that we're not used to hearing it.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, if what people want is a pastor who's going to put on a particular persona when they're being a pastor, and they're going to, you know, talk with their really important preacher voice, and they're going to, like, pretend that they really sort of nailed this, you know, spiritual life of a Christian, and they're going to be the exemplar and the example for what that life looks like. Look, if that's what people want, the good thing is, like, they have so many opportunities to find that in so many churches. But if that's not what they're looking for, if they're looking for somebody who is mostly an example of what it looks like to need grace rather than an example of what it looks like to be the best disciple, then they're okay with me being their pastor. You know, my congregation has said that they love that they have a pastor and a preacher who's clearly preaching to herself and just letting them overhear it.
That was really interesting to read.
Because, I mean, I don't know how I can possibly preach something as being good news if I'm not super clear why the bad news is bad. Meaning, if I'm not clear about why I need grace, then there's no power to me preaching grace. And so when I admit something about myself, it's not to be like, I'm the worst of sinners. It's not really about me. It's so that it creates a sort of holy space around me in which people can step into this safe space around me because I just admitted the thing about myself. And they get to consider what that truth might be for them as well, right? It's a form of leadership I call, screw it, I'll go first.
And I'm guessing that's how your recovery as an alcoholic fits in with being a pastor.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I've spent so much time in, you know, meetings in church basements. You know, I've spent so much time with people in church basements that are speaking so honestly about the struggles of their lives and trying to be prayerful and connect with the power of God. I've spent so much time in that situation in church basements. And yet I don't have that experience much in church sanctuaries upstairs, right? So it feels like sometimes people who are in recovery programs, they are connecting with each other on the level of their shared brokenness, and they're connecting with God on the level of their shared brokenness. And yet if you go upstairs into the sanctuary, it feels like a lot of churches have become places where people can pretend that everything's just fine.
Yeah. Well, in addition to becoming a popular pastor, you've also become a really popular speaker. And you talk in the book about a speaking engagement that you weren't really all that excited about at first. And I'm talking about the 2012 National Youth Gathering in New Orleans, where you spoke to a crowd of 35,000 teenagers and adults. Can you talk about that experience?
Well, like, I told them no twice when they asked me, because I'm pretty sure teenagers don't think I'm cool. I think middle-aged people planning events for teenagers think I'm cool, and that's different, right? So I just thought, no, I'm not the right person. I've never had teenagers as an audience, and I'm not really the right person. But it didn't matter. It didn't matter that I wasn't the right person, because I was just the one who needed to say the thing in the place at the time. It's almost like sometimes I just show up, and even though I'm the one who's like feels like I'm the least qualified to do the thing, I still end up doing the thing, and it works, because in some way it feels like God is present and sort of carrying me through some sort of project that God has for me to participate in. And that's what that event felt like, absolutely, no question. Because the impact of that talk on those kids was phenomenal, and I didn't see it coming, and I didn't know that was going to happen.
Yeah, you got like rip-roaring applause.
No, it was crazy. I think part of it was like, I think that the teenagers were just glad to have an adult be a speaker who wasn't trying to make them like them, right? I wasn't trying to make the kids like me. I wasn't doing this like, this high energy kind of circus, like, come on, guys, you know? I was just like, screw it. I'm just going to be me, and I'm going to talk about my story, and I'm going to talk about it honestly, and that's all I can do. And I talked about my own sort of struggles. And then I talked about how God is a God whose wisdom is perfected in human weakness. And like, that's something to hold on to. That's a place for our hope to lay. And it was just a message that for some reason was just right for that moment for those kids. And I didn't anticipate that at all.
You talk in the book about how you sort of agonized about what you were going to say to these kids. Did you end up scrapping your speech?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, like, I kept trying to get help from my friends because I was so panicked about what to say. And one of them had done youth ministry for a long time and sort of outlined a talk. And they're like, no, you know what these kids need to hear? And she outlined this talk. And I was like, that is a great talk and not one I can give. Like, it's just not me. And so when I decided, you know what, I think there's really just power. It's very traditional in the Christian, in the Christian tradition. It's something that just happens throughout history, and yet we don't really have it right now, which is just the power of testimony. It's just like telling your story honestly. And I think people are really into story right now. That's why StoryCorps is big, and The Moth, and, you know, all these different projects of people telling their stories. It's really powerful. So I just thought, I'm just going to do that. I'm not going to try and convince them of anything. I'm just going to tell my own story and do it as honestly as I can. And that ended up being enough.
But it's scary to tell your own story.
Yeah, it is.
Especially if you've got secrets.
Yeah, the weird thing is, like, I feel like that part of my brain is missing, honestly. Like, my dad was like, honey, you talk about my writing and speaking. He's like, honey, you just have something special. And I go, no, Dad, I think technically I have something missing. It's called shame. Like, I don't have feelings of shame. Like, it's like this part of my brain that doesn't exist. Like, I can just say these horrible things about myself, and I don't have a feeling of shame about it at all. It's just the truth. And, like, why should we be afraid of the truth when it's the thing that Jesus said would set us free?
We're talking with Pastor Nadia Bowles-Weber. She's an ordained Lutheran minister and founder of House for All Sinners and Saints Church in Denver, Colorado. She's not your typical pastor. She's a 6'1", heavily tattooed, ordained Lutheran minister. She's a former stand-up comic and recovering alcoholic. She's also written a New York Times best-selling memoir called Pastrix. Her latest book is Accidental Saints, Finding God in All the Wrong People. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. I'm Lori Mack, in for Faith Middleton. This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack, in for Faith. We're talking today with Pastor Nadia Bowles-Weber. She is a Lutheran minister in Denver, Colorado, where she founded House for All Sinners and Saints Church. And she's written this new book called Accidental Saints. It's about her experiences as a pastor and the practices and people of her congregation. Nadia Bolz-Weber is probably not what most people would picture as their local Lutheran minister. She's 6'1" with sleeve tattoos on both arms. She's a recovering alcoholic and former stand-up comic, and she says it like it is. You talk in the book about people who come to your church and don't believe. And you say you're okay with that.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I'm not responsible for what people believe. I mean, I'm responsible for what they hear, but people believe all kinds of things. It just seems like hubris that I can control that or determine what that should be. So I just give the same message over and over. Honestly, I have like one sermon that I just give a million different ways. And people keep coming to hear it because it's a message that they aren't hearing elsewhere. And I think it's a life-giving message. So, I mean, that's my primary task, I feel like.
Growing up, you had an autoimmune disorder between the ages of 12 and 16 that caused your eyes to bulge. I hope you're not like rolling your eyes right now saying, oh God, I've got to talk about this again.
If I write it in a book, it's fair game for someone to ask me in an interview. So.
Well, that's kind of how I was looking at it. Mm-hmm. You wrote about it in your memoir, Pastrix, and it really wasn't your idea, you say in this book. In fact, you didn't want to write about it, not at all, not ever. You say of all the things you've written about yourself, including your drug use, alcoholism, sexual indiscretion, and so on, writing about the pain and alienation of your childhood made you feel that you might die if you had to tell the story. Can you say a little more about not only that time in your life, but the process of writing about it?
Well, the thing is like, the reason I was afraid to write about that is that it felt like if I even approached writing about it accurately, it would sound like I was exaggerating. Like I didn't know how to be accurate about it without it seeming like it was over the top, because it was a little over the top. I mean, it's not an exaggeration to say that I had, you know, every day of my life for years, I ate my lunch by myself, and I had very particular insults hurled my way. There were particular names that my peers had for me because of how I looked. I mean, incredible alienation. And, you know, everybody had a hard time in middle school. Like, it's a rough time of life. And so I felt like I'm going to just keep it to myself and not talk about that for two reasons. One, I didn't know how to be accurate without it sounding like I was exaggerating. But two, I have sort of overcome that part of my life. And now I'm sort of, you know, I have this sort of big personality, and I have friends who want to be around me, and like, it's just not who I am in a way. And maybe I've sort of cultivated a personality that's actually so different than who I was then. And I didn't want people to know, because it was just too painful. And so it became an issue in my church, because I kept thinking, you know, well, wait, everyone who writes about me is like, oh, she's so hip. She's like a hipster pastor. She's got all these tattoos and so cool. And like, but that's not really who is coming to my church. Like a lot of the people coming to my church are very alien. They've all experienced like alienation, that they can be kind of socially awkward because of that. They're kind of nerdy. And like those are the type of people who were coming. And I thought, oh my gosh, I am attracting people like me, but not like the hip kind of cool people. It's like the 12-year-old eating lunch by herself is attracting the other kids who ate lunch by themselves, right? Like these other people have experienced alienation, and it was like this part of me I didn't want to talk about or admit to, but that little girl is the one who I think has sort of drawn people into this community. It's not the sort of, you know, kind of rock star, you know, hipster pastor that everyone writes about. And that was like a huge realization to me. And it helped me have compassion for myself in a way that I hadn't for maybe ever.
Wow. What was the process of writing about it like for you? How did that go?
Well, I had written all of Pastrix when my editor, Nikki Hubert, gave me the book back and said, you have to talk about that thing you don't want to talk about. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense why you're such a pissed off kid. Because I was so angry. And without that piece of story, it just didn't make any sense. And so I just tried to be brave. I didn't write a lot about it, but I tried to be honest without it seeming self-pitying. And that's a hard balance to strike. And then I can't believe I ended up writing about it again in the next book. I'm like, oh my God, what am I doing? But I had to. And, you know, that chapter where I talk about the realization of the people coming to house and how they're so much like that part of me, what that meant to me personally, that's my favorite chapter in the book. I mean, that's the most sort of personal. And that chapter was hard won. It was. I mean, and I have to say, out of all the chapters in the book, that's the one I am proud of. Yeah.
You're married now and you have two children. What was it like for you to put all of this stuff about yourself out there? Did you find that you wanted to hold back at all?
No, because I mean, I want my kids to be just like real live actual human beings in the world. Like that means that there's some stuff that's kind of icky about their mom, and that means there's some stuff that's hard in the world, and I've never felt like I've had to protect them. And so, and that even means protecting them from the truth of who I am, because I feel like, what kind of message is that to my kids, to say, I want to protect you from the truth of who I am? I'm not interested in that as a project. I'm just not. So, you know, I want them to be able to embrace all of who they are as well. And I think the easiest way to do that is to model it for them.
This is Pastor Nadia Bowles-Weber. She is a Lutheran minister in Denver, where she founded House for All Sinners and Saints Church. And she's written this new book called Accidental Saints. It's about her personal experiences as a pastor, as well as the practices and people of her congregation. Your church has become really quite popular. And you're at a point where, as strange as this sounds, complete with the name House for All, you're actually asking people kind of not to come.
Well, just people who don't actually live in Denver. We want to welcome anybody who is looking for a church home and lives there. We will welcome, absolutely. But it's literally an issue of, we don't have any chairs. And so, you know, our congregation, because I'm a public figure, it can feel like a tourist attraction for anyone who's visiting Denver. And I get they have a curiosity and they've always wanted to come. And we welcome anyone who comes. We do. We'll welcome anyone who comes. But we just ask that people understand we have 185 chairs and over 200 people every Sunday. And so we just don't have the physical capacity to be treated like a cathedral. Like, you know, cathedrals are these big spaces where all the people travel to them. You know, they serve a particular function. But we're a small congregation. So, you know, there was a period after my last book came out where every Sunday people would show up and they'd want to get selfies with me and want me to sign my book. And my congregation is so generous with sharing me. I'm on the road half time, and so they share me a lot. But like on Sunday, those moments, I'm a parish pastor. Like those little moments on Sunday are so precious and so few, and they're for me to go to my parishioner and go, hey, how'd your mom's surgery go? Or like, did you get that job? Or, you know, did you have a better week? Like those moments are for me to connect with the people who are in my care, and not for me to get, you know, for people to ask for selfies or get their book signed. So, you know, we've gotten some slack because we are about welcoming the stranger and being a place for people who are alienated from the church. And we say all are welcome. And so people have given us slack for saying like, we can't handle this many visitors who are here just because our pastor is famous. Mm-hmm. But since we put a statement out just sort of saying, please, please, you know, let us, we want to err on the side of being a congregation and not a destination church. And people have honored that. I mean, it really has taken a little of the pressure off, and people don't ask for selfies and autographs anymore, which is a relief.
It sounds so exhausting.
It is exhausting.
Is it sometimes a bit of a burden to be you and being also a pastor?
But it's an honor. Look, people are willing to listen to what I'm saying and willing to read what I'm writing. Not a lot of people in the world get to make their living doing that. So, like, there's a way in which it's a huge honor that for this moment, it's not forever. I'm not going to remain the person people are listening to. I hope I don't. I hope it's someone else next. But for this moment, it's an honor. Now, having said that, it is exhausting. It's exhausting because I think that because I'm a clergy person, people expect that if I'm out on the road speaking or on a book tour, that I want to hear their stories. And I don't want to hear their story. I literally can't care about thousands of people. And so it feels like a disconnect to them. Since I'm a clergy person, I'm supposed to care. And I literally can't. No one can. You can't carry that much. And so I'm super clear that the only thing I have to offer people who are not my parishioners or friends or family is just what I say from a stage or what I write in a book. Like, there's no sort of access to me as a person that's going to be helpful for people. So it can be exhausting, but I feel like I also want to say, I think the reason people are listening to me, I don't think it has nearly as much to do with me, honestly, as it has to do with an issue of zeitgeist. I think that we're at a moment in time where people have been fed spoonfuls of nonsense and told it was Jesus for so long, and they realize that is not. And so I think that they're hungry for something that is honest and humorous and filled with grace and hope and, like, the real thing, like, it's just, like, authentic, right? So I think people are hungry for that in a way right now, and it just happens to line up with what I'm saying and how I'm saying it. So I don't think it has as much to do with me as it has to do with something that's going on culturally right now.
What do you want us to get from this book?
I don't write with that in mind. I know that's weird. I literally don't. Which is why I'm terrible at giving, like, an elevator pitch. So I don't have that in my mind when I'm writing. But I guess that to be sort of fearless about the truth of our own brokenness, because of the fact that brokenness, that shared brokenness, is the thing that connects us to other people in a way that our victories and successes don't, right? Like, our shared brokenness connects us to other people and connects us to God. I think God really wants to be a restorative, redemptive, forgiving God for us, and it's hard for that to happen if our main relationship to God is one of continually spiritually self-improving ourselves so we never have to bother him.
Nadia Bolz-Weber, it's been a pleasure talking with you, and thank you for joining us today.
You bet. Yeah, thanks so much. Good luck.
The book is called Accidental Saints, Finding God in All the Wrong People. Next, a look at relationship compatibility and finances. I'm Laurie Mack, in for Faith Middleton. This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Laurie Mack, in for Faith. For most of us, our finances are very personal, and money can be a particularly sensitive area when it comes to family discussions. Finances are also the reason a lot of couples argue and split up. Yet many of us enter relationships and even marriage without much discussion at all about the state of our finances or a plan for the future, which my guest says is a big mistake. He's a certified financial planner and says in many couples, at least one partner has no idea what the other one makes as an annual salary. My guest is Jeff Motzke. He's founder, president, and CEO of Trilogy Financial. He lives in Orange County, California, and has written this book, The Couple's Guide to Financial Compatibility. Jeff, is that a rare occasion that one person in a couple doesn't know how much the other one makes?
Well, unfortunately not. It's quite common that couples don't even talk about how much income they make before they get married. And it's sad because it puts them off on a real bad start to being transparent about their relationship when it comes to finances.
Why is being financially compatible important in a relationship?
Well, it's like many other critical parts of your relationship, you know, how or if you want to have kids, how you want to integrate your faith into your relationship. Finances are in the same area because they're pretty much tied to everything that goes on. How you want to spend money, how you want to save money, what your goals are in life. And if you're not on the same page with your goals in life, for example, if one of you wants to buy a home and the other wants to travel more, or one of you wants to put your kids into a different type of college education than the other, and you're not talking about these issues, you're going to have a lot of financial stress. The other part that comes out is that, unfortunately, Americans right now, we're too much spenders instead of savers. And because of that, that's causing an awful lot of stress in the relationship, because we're spending more and we're not in most cases, paying yourself first, which is taking money out of the family household or the paycheck first and putting it towards important goals as a couple in life. And until you start doing something as simple as that, you're going to run into a lot of problems because you're going to probably end in a lot of debt and you're going to be arguing over debt. We've got the average household with about $15,000 in revolving credit card debt. And it's an equal opportunity marriage destroyer, whether you're wealthy or you're not wealthy. Having credit card debt, and it's just a huge problem. And it's a difficult for people to get out of as well. And I think that's something that I teach people with what I call it the three highlighter exercise, where if you're struggling with credit cards or you don't know where your money's going every single month, sit down with three highlighters, one color being, I say green, because that would be your basic expenses that you're paying with the credit card, your food, gas, things that you need to run the family household. Then take another color, and those are more of your lifestyle type decisions, and make it yellow. And these would be your entertainment, travel, things like that. And then finally, get another one, and you can use a red pen if you want or any other color. And these are the emotional, frivolous expenses that we put on credit because it's so easy to do. And you'd be surprised when I've had couples go through this exercise how often they realize how much money they're spending in the second two categories. And if they really sat down and figured out, saying, this doesn't make sense for our family household, we should be thinking things differently and funding other goals that we think are important. And once couples start doing something as simple as that, or they start figuring out what their goals are together, then they're emotionally motivated to start doing something about it. And that's when the real change occurs, when people make that emotional decision to change.
It's interesting because, you know, as couples start to get to know each other, it seems so awkward to start talking about plans when it comes to finances or even to poke around into that kind of stuff. I'm not sure how many new couples you see, but do you find people a little uncomfortable about delving into that with each other?
Yeah, that's a good point. I always say I wouldn't ask about somebody's credit score on the first date, but I would start to see signs of things. If you see somebody that's always spending a lot and always seems like they're dressing to the nines and all that, and then you're trying to match up maybe what their career is, and you're realizing, how is this person doing this? That's a real tell that you should start thinking about, is this somebody you really want to have a relationship with? Because if you don't agree on some of the basic saving and spending type of things, you're going to run into trouble down the road. Even if you have the other emotions and things that are involved in a relationship, if you don't agree on money to some degree, and you're not going to agree on everything, but if you don't agree on money to some degree and how you want to have that be part of your plan and out of your life, you're going to have all kinds of problems. I mean, the studies are out there that show if you argue about money, you know, once a week, you're like 40% more likely to get divorced. If it comes to daily, you're almost 70% more likely to get divorced. And you don't want to have that be the reason for separation.
I want to say that in the book, you start off with a 34-question quiz at the beginning.
Right.
What did the results of that quiz tell you? And maybe we can even, you know, give some examples of the questions.
Yeah, that quiz was really what got my mind going on writing a book, because I had been using that with couples for years and realizing what a great conversation starter it was for couples to start talking about all the what-ifs in life when it comes to finances and family and so forth. And I used it with clients, and they said, this is great. And what I found with the quiz was when they left my office, I know they were talking about these topics in a positive, constructive manner, and it was a conversation starter. But the quiz really breaks down into trust issues, planning issues, lifestyle decisions, and those are all areas that it breaks the categories on. The area that people struggle the most in when they take the quiz is the planning aspect, because that's the part where, you know, unfortunately, most Americans don't have a household budget. 70% of Americans don't operate off of a household budget. So you're already at a real negative defensive position if you don't know where your money's going. It's like trying to build a financial house without blueprints. So to me, that's the area that they need the most help. And what was interesting with the quiz is that most people scored well in the trust area, which to me was real positive. That means that they trust each other in their decisions. They're transparent with each other. That was the best area. The second best area was the lifestyle type areas was an area that it did fine into. And then the final one was risk. And the other problem with risk was people just don't understand risk, so therefore they didn't score real well in the quiz.
Is there a section that's more telling in that quiz than another, or a couple of questions that really kind of drive the points home for you?
Yeah, the one that I look at a lot when I'm with couples is you get the opportunity to rate your spouse in spending and education on finances. And what I find interesting is that spouses are pretty on the same page in rating each other, yet they sometimes don't want to know what the results are. but it's an area where when they're rating each other, they realize that, my wife's a spender or my husband's a spender, or they're more of a saver, I'm more of a saver. And it goes through essentially a rating of 1 through 5, and then it adds that up. And people are pretty dead on in most cases in that area. Where they're really off in the quiz, what I find is what I call the things they don't think about in life. And that's another big thing, is being proactive in your discussions with your spouse and not reactive. And for example, if they're doing a part of the quiz and there's a question on there about family and what happens if for some reason mom or dad ends up needing long-term care or needs help, assisted living help, how are you going to handle that? And that's a topic that most Americans have never talked about. And let me say, if you haven't talked about it and you're reactive and emotional, people are going to make really poor decisions there. But if you talk about it ahead of time and you've discussed it maybe even with your siblings, if they're involved as well, you make good decisions because you've been planning ahead.
This is Jeff Motzke. He's president and CEO of Trilogy Financial and author of The Couple's Guide to Financial Compatibility. I bet that is very complicated, especially when it comes to the finances of parents. I'm guessing that a lot of adults don't know what their parents have.
Very true. And what's good about the generation that's in retirement or, in their 70s and 80s, they were much better savers than their children were in a lot of ways. A lot of them grew up or have memories of the Depression, so therefore they're better savers, which is good. They actually usually have more money than the kids think that they have in a lot of scenarios. So that's very helpful. They're also ones that, in a lot of cases, own their own home. They don't have a lot of debt, so that's very helpful when it comes to planning as well. So as a kid or as a child of a parent like that, you want to spend time at some point talking to mom and dad in the right environment to ask them about their future and what their plans are, because a lot of times that's a real touchy topic for moms and dads too. But pick the right environment, pick a safe environment. I always say this with couples, have a financial date night, which to me, that is once a month, sit down and go over your finances together. And I'm not talking about pulling out all the credit cards. I'm talking about goals in life, where you see yourselves going. It's the same thing. Have a family meeting. And I've conducted a lot of these with the siblings and the moms and dads in my office, where we've talked about how things are going to go and how the planning needs to go for mom and dad. And it's just one of those things where being proactive on it is far, far better than being reactive. And I've seen it work really, really well where, we have those discussions ahead of time. The big thing about mom and dad is they don't want to be a burden on their kids. That's one of the huge things. And they don't want to run out of money. So if those are the two things that you have to worry about, the kids can step in and make sure that they're not a burden and make mom and dad just enjoy the rest of their retirement and their life.
We didn't even get into investments, and I know that that's really tough to speak broadly about because everybody's situation is different. It has to do with, how much time versus how much money you make. But what can you say about investments?
Investments need to be tied to goals. So you need to take your investments and figure out what your time frames are. If you're looking to save for a home and your time frames are a couple years or less, you need to be very safe with how you're putting that money away. You need to be very low volatility. On the other hand, if you're younger and you're saving for retirement or financial independence, and I would say that's the day that work becomes an option, if that's your case, and I don't really care what the stock market does today or 5 years from now, if your retirement date is 2029, we've got a long time horizon. We can take more risk in that area too. Two things I would say, though, when it comes to investing is that you have to understand what you own. So whatever you're buying, whatever it is, understand what it is. And if you don't know what it is, get a high-quality advisor that can help you explain what you own. That's key. And then it has to pass what I call the sleep test. If you're up at night or your spouse is up at night and they can't sleep because they are scared of the investments, or they saw their last statement and they're just, they can't sleep. That's a problem, and you need to sit down and you need to dial down the risk or get back into the first part, which is understanding what you own. So I really believe in those two things first, and then tying the investment to the goal and the time frame makes all the difference.
You mentioned retirement, which makes me think about Social Security. It seems like the message these days is to work as long as possible, but that isn't necessarily for everybody, is it?
That's a good point. I've seen a lot of studies recently, and that's a complicated question. And I always tell people that make sure you sit down and make an informed decision there, because if you make a mistake on Social Security, it usually becomes permanent pretty quickly. And if you're still working, I'm not a big fan of taking Social Security early at all if you're still working, because you're probably going to get taxed on it, and you permanently reduced your benefits in those cases. And my feeling is, if you were working before and you had the same income, why do you need Social Security all of a sudden to supplement something else? You'd be better off to let that accumulate until you at least reach your normal retirement age with Social Security, and that date now is usually 66 or 67. Then at least you're getting your normal retirement age income, and it's considerably higher than if you take it early. There is a lot of people out there that say wait until age 70 because you get an 8% credit. That can be too if you're still working. That can make some sense if you're healthy, if you've got a significantly younger spouse. But all those things need to be analyzed, and we actually use a Social Security software when we sit down with clients to explain the benefits, how they work, what's going to be best for their particular situation. But not a big fan of taking it early, and not necessarily a fan of waiting forever to take it as well. But I like to at least wait till normal retirement age, and in particular, if they're still working.
Money, as we've been discussing, is complicated. And it seems like there are at least two sides. There's the side that consists of the facts. This is what you earn. This is what you've saved or haven't saved. These are the real numbers in front of you. And on the other side, there's a big psychological component to money that's probably as individual as your memories of childhood or even how you grew up.
You're absolutely right. I do a radio show as well, and I talk about finances and behavior having such an impact on somebody's overall plan versus just money and rates of return and portfolios. Behavioral decisions that you make have a huge impact on your overall financial success. Kids learn from their parents, and I will tell you that it's very interesting in most cases where if you've got a kid that grew up in a household that didn't have a lot of wealth, didn't have a lot of money, and now they're financially successful, generally speaking, they're very cautious and they're very careful and they want to save their money. They have that same roots from their parents. On the other hand, if they grew up in a household that had a lot of wealth or they spent a lot of money, they're going to do the same thing in most cases, unless it got to the point where it got so ugly in their parents' house that they say, I want the exact opposite of that. But in most cases, they're going to mimic to a large degree what they saw in their household. And it's tricky. It's important to teach kids about money. I spend a lot of time in various schools and so forth talking to kids about money and how it works and so forth. And it's just amazing that it's not taught enough in the classroom. I wish it was taught more.
Jeff, were you surprised at how much psychology is involved in your job?
Yes. I started in this business right out of school, and I will say early on, I thought it was all about numbers and analytics, and I'm very good in that area. I was going to be a calculus teacher before I got into this business. So I understand that area, but what I realized early on was that the behavior and the relationships and the decision-making and the ability to relate to people and listen to people and understand was far more important than knowing how to do alpha and beta and R-squared and standard deviation. They don't get that, or they don't even want to talk about that. You have to be able to connect with them. And I didn't realize that early on. I need to feel the connection that they like me and I like them. And I call it a professional friendship. And to me, that's important.
Well, you take an interesting approach at what can be a difficult topic for couples. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, and this is such an important topic. I'm so glad that you and others are bringing it out to light, because I really want to see couples be on the same page and succeed financially, because it's fun to watch.
Jeff Motzke is founder, president, and CEO of Trilogy Financial. He lives in Orange County, California, and has written the book, The Couple's Guide to Financial Compatibility. It's out in paperback. I'm Laurie Mack, in for Faith Middleton. Thanks for listening.